Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, an editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, I spoke with Dr. David Vossler, the medical director of the Neuroscience Institute at UW-Medicine Valley Medical Center and a professor at the university. He discussed the findings of a recently published phase 3 dataset on lacosamide and its effects on reducing primary generalized tonic-clonic seizures.
My name's David Vossler, and I am clinical professor of neurology at University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle. One thing I would say from the outset is this term primary, you may or may not know, was abandoned a little over 3 years ago. It's a leftover from the past, and of course, we began these studies it was conceived in 2010, 10 years ago. And then we began a series of studies, the pilot study in 2011, and then this big study some years later. And so it's kind of a relic. So, and also idiopathic, those terms were abandoned by the International League Against Epilepsy in April 2017. And they're called genetic generalized onset tonic-clonic seizures, just for the record. The current landscape is that really beginning in 1995, although we've had close to 30 new anti-seizure medications developed, we've only four of them have gone through clinical trial process and actually got an FDA approval for generalized onset tonic-clonic seizures. So those are lamotrigine, topiramate, Keppra, levetiracetam, and the most recent one was perampanel. It was many years before that one, a big gap there of about 15 years before perampanel got approved. So that plus the old drug, Depakote or divalproex, valproic acid, really are the five mainstay drugs that we have had to use. Old drugs like phenobarbital and phenytoin and phenytoin's derivative primidone or mycelene technically were approved for this, but it wasn't based really on any clinical trials. And most of us do not use barbiturates like phenobarb or primidone. And sometimes phenytoin, being a sodium channel blocker, can exacerbate the patients that may help their tonic-clonic seizures, but a lot of them also have absence seizures or they'll have myoclonic seizures, and sometimes those are exacerbated. So we tend to stay away from the barbiturates and we tend to stay away from phenytoin. So that leaves us with the five drugs, valproate, lamotrigine, topiramate, levetiracetam, and perampanel. We have patients who literally don't respond to those drugs alone or in various combinations or pure permutations. And so we desperately needed a new anti-seizure medication.
And now, obviously, you mentioned the sort of different types of seizures that these patients do experience. And just for sort of, the audience's knowledge, how often would you say, or how often do you know that patients are experiencing this specific type of seizure that we were targeting in the study?
Well, patients with these epilepsies with genetic generalized onset tonic-clonic seizures comprise, it's said, about 40% of patients. We know that in children, that number is probably about that high, probably actually a little bit higher, maybe 60%. But because some of those kids remit by the time they hit adulthood, the percentage is lower. So we've always said that in kids, probably 60% have generalized onset seizures and 40% have focal onset seizures. And just the opposite, about 40% of generalized, in a, sorry, 40% of adults have generalized onset seizures and probably 60% have focal. That's just a rough, you know, it's an old saw. And again, it's because some of these kids remit. And so the number goes from 60 generalized to 40 generalized and the focals grow. Some of those patients, it's a spectrum. It's a variety of different patients. There's many, many different genes that can cause these generalized onset seizure types, epilepsy syndromes, actually. And there's a few that they only have tonic-clonic seizures. That's their only seizure type. But the majority will have coexistent separate at a different time from their tonic-clonic convulsion. They'll have an absence seizure or they'll have a myoclonic seizure. Some will have all three types. It's interesting because they're different brain mechanisms, but it's all part of the same condition, the same genetic mutation.
So then getting toward, lacosamide and this phase three study, you know, before we sort of get into any of the nitty gritty from the findings, I'm curious, you know, how, for with your experience that you've had with it, working in the study and whatnot, how do you think that lucosamide sort of might make an impact on that need for patients with these types of seizures? And does it offer anything potentially unique in it, in its mechanism or just sort of how it operates?
Right. Well, a couple of different things there. First of all, it does have a different mechanism of action. It enhances slow inactivation of sodium channels, and that's unlike any drug on the market right now that's effective in generalized onset seizures. So it is mechanistically different, and it's effective, as we'll talk about. It's very effective in this study. I have confidence in that. We'll come back to efficacy, and I'm sure in a few minutes. But I think the main thing that I like about lucosamide for focal onset epilepsy is good tolerability, and we don't have big time organ toxicity like we have with valproic acid or divalproex. It's got a lot of, as you probably know, a lot of organ toxicity. We don't know about teratogenesis with lucosamide yet. It's been around for 11 years, but you'd think we know more by now, but it takes a very, very long time. With the pregnancy registries, the six major pregnancy registries around the world, takes them a long time to gather this post-marketing information. So we still don't know where lucosamide sits, but we know valproate's a bad actor, so to speak, very bad. Lamotrigine and levetiracetam are better. Topiramate has problems as well. It's second only probably to valproate. And perampanel, again, that's a new one. We don't know. So I think, you know, in terms of teratogenesis, it's unknown. But in terms of things like organ toxicity, pick one, kidney problems, liver problems, bone marrow problems, we're not seeing that with lucosamide. And we have an 11-year international track record with that medication. So I think we can really say confidently, we don't think there's going to be a smoking gun coming out, you know, that after 11 years and millions of patients using it, I don't think we'll see anything there. And likewise, psychiatric wise, we don't get psych problems like we do with some other drugs. I don't want to make too many comparator statements here because we'll avoid that. But three of those five drugs have some significant psychiatric problems with them in terms of adverse effects. So tolerability, safety is good, low rash rate. No kidney stones, no liver problems, no bone marrow problems of any significance. So I think that sort of this combination, a triple combination, a novel mechanism of action, good safety and tolerability, and efficacy really are going to, in my opinion, make this a drug that'll be here to stay for a long, long time in the treatment of these patients.
So overall, nothing stood out as far as, you know, to just sort of start there, since you mentioned the safety, just nothing stood out or concerning safety wise or adverse event wise.
Yeah, that's correct. There is a little bit of pre-PR, EKG PR, interval prolongation, well known. It's been characterized for over a decade and a half. It's been well known. It's well published. And we did not see anything at all different in this study, anything new, anything concerning. There were no deaths in the study, either from any cause or from SUDEP, which is good because this is a group of patients that's prone to SUDEP. And in the 24 weeks of this particular study, we saw nothing. We didn't see any of those.
So then sort of getting into the efficacy endpoints and the other findings, you know, what were you obviously overall hoping to, I guess, sort of walk the audience through, hoping to see? What were you guys evaluating? And then, and what are your main sort of main takeaways from these data?
Yeah, well, I'll say I first got involved, as I said, in this study, studying this particular indication with this drug in January of 2011. And that was in the SP961 study. It was a pilot proof of concept study in adults that we began, as I say, back in January 2011. So it's been a long road. And we studied about 30 patients, and I had three of those 30. And what I saw, Matt, were two of those three became completely seizure free. And these patients were very, very treatment resistant. People don't enroll typically in experimental studies of any kind when they can be easily treated with things on the market. And these patients were no exception in that early 961 study. Based on that, in that data, that study was published, I was championing this with UCB. There was kind of a holdup. I think the company was busy working on subsequent products, not subsequent to Briviact, Vimpat, but they're working at Briviact. And so, you know, can only do so much research. And also the FDA, as my understanding, wanted a pediatric, the children to be looked at as well. So they introduced a delay probably of 4 or 5 years following the completion of the 961 study until we got this one, the study protocol set, got the FDA to approve it, and then got going internationally. I think, you know, based on my experience with the 961 study, you know, it's an N of 3, but 2 out of 3 were seizure-free. and they hadn't been seizure-free with anything. And I consider myself, you know, as an experienced epileptologist and I'm vice chair for the Council on Clinical Activities, the American Epilepsy Society. I was trying all kinds of things. So I was really pretty excited. We wanted to show that this was an effective drug. We wanted to show its safety and tolerability profile. And we did that. And I'm very, very pleased about that.
So did any particular data points or trends numerically sort of stand out for you for any reason? And if so, why?
Yeah, the primary efficacy endpoint was a little different for this study, as you may have seen. It was a time to second tonic-clonic seizure. It was kind of a novel design. Retrospectively, people had done this time to third seizure post hoc analysis of lamotrigine, and they, you know, lamotrigine got approved, but then they said, hey, if we looked at it from time to third tonic-clonic seizure, would that have worked? Would that design have worked? And it would have for lamotrigine. For this drug, because you can titrate it up faster, you have to go very, very slow and low with lamotrigine to avoid Stevens-Johnson syndrome. So this one, we can go straight up over 4 weeks for the adults, 6 for the children. And so we thought, well, you know, we could do time to second seizure. Well, we didn't do time to first because they would potentially be titrating up, and you haven't even reached stable dose. So that's why time to second seizure was picked. And to me, that, I mean, that was the primary efficacy endpoint, and we met that. And then when you look at, because in the 24 weeks of the study, less than half of the lacosamide patients had that second tonic-clonic seizure, whereas the placebo patients did it in 11 weeks. So 50% had a second tonic-clonic seizure in the placebo group in 11 weeks, and the lacosamide group didn't. I mean, less than 50% was out here somewhere. So, you know, that was impressive. And then looking at it with the Kaplan-Meier analysis, the survival analysis, it remains statistically significant, you know, out at 24 months, and there was early separation. So that was really the thing that stood out, was the primary efficacy endpoint. And then secondarily, you know, we looked at the estimated seizure freedom rate, the Kaplan-Meier estimated seizure freedom rate, and we also looked at the observed seizure freedom rate, and both of those were significant. So the efficacy, I think, because the tolerability and safety was there, and there were no surprises, there was nothing new, and we'd seen all this in prior studies with lacosamide, it basically came down to being an efficacy research study, and that's what stood out.
And now, obviously, correct me if I'm wrong, but this agent was used adjunctively during this study for patients who were already on a number of agents. I believe it was up to 3.
Right. They were on up to, if they were on a benzo, the benzo would count as 1, and then they could be on 2 other non-benzos. If they were not on a benzo, let's say clonazepam for myoclonic seizures, that was a common one, then they would just be on 2 non-benzo drugs. So yes, it was adjunctive, randomized, placebo versus lacosamide.
And now, I'm not sure if this was an analysis that was conducted, but you know, were there any particularly promising pairings with other available agents? Obviously, you know, taking a number with most of these patients, I would imagine being on a number of different other agents, and this being an adjunctive therapy, is there are there agents it pairs best with, or is it kind of across the board showing?
You know, we're working on that now. So we're doing these post hoc analyses, and we'll be presenting those at some of the upcoming meetings around the world in Europe, Australia, Japan, and here especially. It's supposed to be here in Seattle in December, the American Epilepsy Society, but it'll be here virtual, unfortunately. I think all of these will be virtual, right? So it doesn't matter where they are supposed to be held. They're all going to be virtual. But so I don't have that information, no.
So last thing before I let you go, first off, thank you again for all your time. But is there anything else to add or mention about the agent, the study, any you know, points that stuck out to you or just things that you wanted to add?
Well, I guess the only minor thing is sort of a logistical thing, and that is, although we didn't look at intravenous lacosamide and starting it sort of acutely, this was an outpatient study, obviously a clinic study, and this was so one thing is that, you know, in a more inpatient environment where maybe somebody is hospitalized with tonic-clonic seizures and their generalized onset, and the EEG video monitoring shows that, you know, we might, as practitioners, think about lacosamide maybe higher up rather than other drugs that are difficult to use. First of all, perampanel, topiramate, and lamotrigine don't come in an intravenous form. Only levetiracetam and valproate do. So if they've already failed valproate and they can't tolerate levetiracetam, I'm just making a case example, somebody in the hospital emergency room, neuro hospitalist, might consider lacosamide, adding that as opposed to something else, and can be given. We aren't approved for primary generalized tonic-clonic seizures, but the intravenous form is approved if you want to initiate someone on Vimpat for focal onset epilepsy. That's one thing. I mean, again, I guess I would also emphasize that we know patients who have generalized tonic-clonic seizures, particularly when they have them in their sleep, that's an independent risk factor for SUDEP, sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. And that's obviously a fatal event. We don't have data that this would prevent that. But again, it gives us a good treatment option. One of the things I was going to say is, as mentioned, a lot of these patients had tried a number of anti-epileptic drugs already and failed. These were really potentially, some of them, not all, but some of them were more difficult to treat patients with epilepsy. What will this show in clinical practice, maybe if it's used earlier in the course of treatment, not waiting so many years, that's going to remain to be seen. But that would be in clinical practice if and when the drug gets approved by regulatory agencies.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.